You're listening to a feed of the Association of Music Podcasting at musicpodcasting.org.
Hello and welcome to Mikey Pod. This is episode 149, long-awaited episode 149, if you will. Today's guest is Robert Conroy, who is half of the duo known as Misty Roses. We'll be talking. We met actually in Christopher Street Park. We didn't meet, but we met to do this interview in Christopher Street Park. And so you'll hear all the city background noises and all that sort of stuff. Hope that is enhances the mood of the interview rather than detracts from it. You'll have to let me know. You can write to me at mikeypod@gmail.com. The website is mikeypod.com. And I think that's all you need to know. This first song we're going to listen to is called Dreaming of Delphine. And after that, we'll be talking with Robert.
Sleepiest of sleepers sleeping, and I've been dreaming of Delphine
of sleepers sleeping, and I've been dreaming of Delphine again.
So I'm here in whatever the name of the park with the gay statues.
Which
I can't remember the name of it.
Hold on for a second. Wait.
He's going to go look at the name of the park. Christopher Park. Yeah.
I have lived here my whole fucking life.
So you have been here all your life.
Yes.
So Robert Conroy from Misty Roses.
Yes.
Hello, welcome.
Hi there.
We just listened to one of your songs. And why don't you tell us about that song?
That song is called Dreaming of Delphine. And it is our homage. I mean, the sort of central point on the lyrics and the concept behind it is it's a kind of jumping off point is Delphine Seyrig, the French actress, the sort of a lot of people call her kind of like the art house cinema goddess. She's just like this amazing actress who kind of worked with all the great European directors in the 50s and 60s. She died very young, tragically, really young, in like 1990 of lung cancer. And to me, she's just like the sort of embodiment of that kind of really special, really kind of super intelligent glamour of those films and of those kind of people, you know, involved in, you know, involved in that kind of filmmaking and that sort of art. So she's very much, she's very iconic for me, you know. I'm there are loads of, being a gay man and all, surprise, surprise, there are loads of women who are these, like, sort of ultra iconic women. And because I went to film school and, you know, saw a lot of this stuff, you know, just with, it was amazing. Because when I was in college, I went to film school and the CUNY system, and I had a gig as a projectionist. So essentially, I was going to classes and seeing movies, and then to pay the bills, I was going to other classes and running the movies that they were watching. Yeah. So I just had this, like, diabolical amount of film studies kind of just crammed into me.
Yeah.
And so all, you know, those films become incredibly important to me. And like I said, as a gay man, you know, and the kind of obsessions we get about really sort of powerful women, particularly those women in those European films, Jean Moreau, Monica Vitti, Lee Vollman, you know, Isabella Gianni, Anna Karenina, you know, Delphine Seyrig, they just became these kind of iconic women for me.
Okay. I noticed a lot of that in the just in the music, even when you're not referencing a film. It's very cinematic what you guys do.
We're very taken with, you know, soundtracks are an enormous part of what we do, you know, of what we based Johnny Pearl, who's the other half of the band, who's in London, and myself kind of based it on. We both had a real love of this kind of music that sort of pop music, but wasn't really rock and roll. And you know, we generally sort of liked all that music that kind of that existed kind of on the, I wouldn't say so much in the periphery, but kind of alongside rock and roll through the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, and things like Soundtrack Records, Bossa Nova Records, French pop, you know, the records by Serge Gainsbourg and Jacques Brel, and you know, and soundtrack music generally, Ennio Morricone, John Barry, Jerry Goldsmith, and, Lalo Schifrin, Henry Mancini, all that kind of stuff. And then we both really have a great appreciation of things, you know, which I think now people kind of appreciate primarily as kitsch, but we really like it, you know, easy listening records.
Yeah.
You know, which we really like. We both really like. I don't think either of us view it. I mean, sometimes it's you know, Percy Faith's record of Jesus Christ Superstar, where he goes through every single song on Jesus Christ Superstar, it is kind of kitschy, because Jesus Christ Superstar is kind of kitschy, you know, right from the get-go.
Yeah.
But I'm really, you know, I find it quite really beautiful. So,
yeah.
You know, it's not simply for camp value, though, even though there's usually a lot of camp value there.
And you guys actually do a good job of bringing the kitsch into non-kitschiness, while still sort of giving a nod to the kitschiness. How's that for using the word kitsch?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I get very testy with people when they call something kitsch or smaltzy or camp, and because I don't necessarily think that something that's like, say, library music or I don't know, Percy Faith, or God, I'm suddenly drawing a blank on other people, Martin Denny or Les Baxter, or I don't necessarily view that as kitsch. It is kitsch almost by definition, but if you get, I think a lot of people can, you know, that classification allows a lot of people to simply dismiss it and not to go into it and listen to how beautiful the music is.
Right.
I mean, of course it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, like a Yima Sumac record is freaking ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's actually quite moving and beautiful if you let yourself actually get into listening to the record.
Yeah. And the intention of the artist wasn't to be ridiculous.
No, I don't think it was.
Yeah.
You know, it's you know, it was a very odd... probably very politically incorrect, you know, like, you know, this whole notion. But I also think it's weird, because I also feel like there's a kind of, you know, when Martin Denny would do these records that were all damaged by, like, I think he quite appreciated things like gamelan records. And of course, when he's taking some gamelan instruments and then putting it into this kind of cocktail-y jazz combo that's now going to do, you know, These Are a Few of My Favorite Things or something like that, or something from The Sound of Music or something like that, and have bird calls in it. I don't think he's doing it as an act of cultural imperialism. Do you know what I mean?
I think
it was quite innocent, you know,
right,
in what they were going for. There's a part of you that can look at it like as cultural imperialism, because, like, holy fuck, like, you know, look what they're doing with it. But but the material itself is really interesting. And I think sometimes some of the most interesting material is when people get stuff wrong, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like when, you know, I have absolutely no interest. There are loads of people out there, for example, who do white people, for lack of a better terminology, who will do absolutely perfect versions of the blues.
Yeah.
And I have absolutely no interest in them. When Nick Cave does a record like the second Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds record, The Firstborn Is Dead, and he kind of gets the blues all wrong, that's what's really great.
Right.
Because then it's a really interesting record. He's trying to make a blues record, but it kind of ends up being all weird and German and European and off
but
center.
But then it's like something new.
And then it's something new and it's something interesting.
Yeah.
Where, you know, where you, if you do it and you get it note for note perfect, well, who cares?
Yeah.
Then go, you know, it's like, is that going to, are you going to be able to say anything that Robert Johnson didn't already say better?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, or Bessie Smith or somebody didn't already say, like, twice as good?
Yeah.
I think
your chain is stuck.
My chain is stuck. I am an idiot. Just for you people in the internet world, I'm wearing my chain from the Leatherman on my, and it's this bench worth it that holds my keys and my wallet, and this bench is the perfect slat size for it just to get stuck.
Yeah, so then we're
over and over again.
Bondage thing.
Yes, it's a little bondage thing. There was actually a really hot leather guy who was just taking photos. I think he was taking photos of us talking there.
Oh, really?
Second. Yeah, he's taking of the sculptures and then us. Anyway, but I digress. So
you guys work from New York and London?
Yeah, we didn't start out that way. When we first started, you know, we were both living in New York, and we got introduced through a mutual friend, and we kind of immediate. And Johnny, at that point, I met Johnny. He had seen the band I was singing with at that time, and my kind of tenure with that band was ending. And Johnny was said, you know, like, well, this is really interesting. You know, we seem to be right on the same page. Literally, our friend Antonio, who introduced us, I had said to him, oh, I'm really into Scott Walker and Julie London. And and he was like,
they go together perfectly.
Yeah, they go together. And I think so, actually. And Antonio said, there's only one other person in the world who's into Scott Walker and Julie London, and that's my friend Johnny. And he introduced us. And Johnny was already planning to move back. He and his girlfriend were already planning to move back to England or to the UK. I think they actually were planning to move to Scotland, and that didn't work out that way. And we knew. And literally, we sat down and we said, well, maybe we should try writing a song. And I think we wrote the demos for 3 or 4 songs on our first album in the first evening. We had, like, good working demos in the first evening. It was coming that quick.
Oh, wow.
So we kind of realized, oh, shit, we have something good here. And so we just plowed through an album before we left town. And then since then, we've been doing it. So, like, our first record, Komodo Dragons, is very, if you listen to that album, and then listen to Villainous, which is kind of, because we have Komodo Dragons, we have Monster Zero, which is sort of in between, because it's kind of a little longer than an EP, but shorter than an album.
Yeah.
And then we have Villainous, the record that came out this past year. I think the first record is much more conventional in the sense of its strong song structures, because we were in the same room together for all those songs. You know, like sitting there working them out. When we get to Villainous, it all begins to become about internet badminton, and he would send me an idea, and then I'd send it back, and send me an idea. And sometimes, you know, I'd run off with an idea. He'd send me something, and it just says, oh, well, here's something. I'm pestering him for an idea, and he sends me something. And then I hear it, I write a melody. I'll write vocals, I'll write the words, And our producer, Steve Wright, lives in New York now. He's British, but he lives in New York. So we'd finish it. And we'd be like, okay, here's the finished song. And it would be, I kind of would always get some emails, from panicked emails from Johnny, where he's like, wait a second, that's not done. I didn't finish it with that. I would be like, no, it is. It's finished now. You know, wow. You'd be like, wait a second, I wanted to change this aspects of the structure. I was like, well, it's not going to be, because we just finished it. So it's funny. I think for a couple of songs, particularly on this record, Johnny was kind of like, what? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
It's done. I just kind of gave you the preliminary idea. I had this idea that I would change this, I'd change that, and I'd essentially finish it.
Yeah.
But so that was kind of like, there was these really kind of interesting opportunities for mutation,
yeah,
if you know what I mean, that happened because we weren't in the same room together.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's a lot slower. The process ends up being a lot slower because we're not in the same room sometimes. But definitely with our last album, it was really interesting because I really felt like the songs kind of began to dictate their own agendas, which was really fun.
Yeah.
You know, we'd start writing stuff, and then I'd finish, you know, something closer to being finished and go like, where is this coming from? This is not what I wanted it to sound like.
Right.
And I think it was even more so for Johnny, because Steve and I are here, so we're kind of like finishing mixes here and then sending them back to him. So the song's actually kind of, particularly on Villainous, I mean, pretty much on Monster Zero and Villainous, but particularly on Villainous, they began to get their own agendas. They had their own, they had began to plot their own courses.
Oh, that's interesting.
And run away from you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the thing is that you sometimes just try not to get in the way of them when they run away from you.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to something else from Villainous.
Okay.
Starry Wisdom is what we have next.
Starry Wisdom, if you've seen Bruce LaBruce's film Otto or Up With Dead People, which is a very good film, which I would have to say that even if it didn't prominently use two of our songs. This is over the end credits to this. And this is a lot of the stuff on this record is Villainous is homages to people, to particular actors or actresses, or, you know, just people who really inspired us and, you know, me, because I wrote the lyrics. And this is dedicated to Curtis Harrington, who was a openly gay director. He made a lot of really interesting experimental films in the late 50s and early 60s. He ran with people like Kenneth Anger and Maya Darren. And then he started making commercial films, like odd little horror movies. And at the end of his life, he became incredibly successful because he directed a gazillion Dynasty episodes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So a bunch of the Dynasty episodes are directed by Curtis Harrington.
Interesting.
And he passed away last year. And what's really cool, this song, the title, Starry Wisdom, is kind of something I'm snagging from H.P. Lovecraft. A reference from his horror story, The Haunter of the Dark. There's this, they're not satanic because it's H.P. Lovecraft, but this evil cult that who have a church called Starry Wisdom. I think it's something like the Order of Starry Wisdom or the Church of Starry Wisdom, and they worship an intergalactic nasty eats people in the neighborhood and stuff like that. And but most of the images are all stuff that we snagged from this film Night Tide that Curtis Harrington directed, and it's this really beautiful, evocative, it's his first feature, and it's Dennis Hopper's in it, and it's about this sailor who falls in love with this young lady who may or may not be a monster, who may or may not be nuts. And what was really cool about this was Bruce, when I said, Bruce asked, I want to use this, and I explained that all to him in an email, and email immediately came back. He said, Robert, you don't understand, like, Night Tide was an enormous influence on me to make this movie. Like, I was watching Night Tide, and that's where I started writing Otto. So it was just like, ooh. So it was very, like, I think the spirit of Curtis Harrington was, like, there.
Guiding
us.
Yeah.
So this is...
All right.
Yeah.
All right, so let's listen to
Okay, cool.
Don't
you find the sea enchanting? Dear, can't you hear what the surf is saying? Speaking spells of stars. Telling haunted lovers. They chase big skirts around strange corners and
Okay, so that was Misty Roses with Starry Wisdom. Starry Wisdom?
Starry Wisdom.
All right. Did I say it right?
From The Haunter of the Dark. Really good short story, if you ever.
Oh,
really good,
check it
scary
out. I love doing interviews like this where I'm like, I need to take notes like of all the references.
Yes.
But I'm keeping up pretty well. I'm kind of proud of myself. So we talked a little bit before, we were having coffee before the interview about like some bands nowadays, these young little
yes.
kids that aren't doing such a great job. But which made me like wonder about what your influences are in general. I mean, you mentioned some before, but
yeah, I mean, like a lot of the Johnny kind of came up with this term, like sort of the middle of the road mavericks. These people who made these records that were very, very sort of popular pop music, but are really odd when you actually begin to dissect them. So Scott Walker records. Scott Walker is a ginormous influence on what we do. It was something that really brought us together to work together because we were both really obsessed with Scott Walker's
he is
records.
So scary,
yeah.
I have to say.
And, I mean, and when you hear these records, you know, like a friend of mine once brilliantly described it, it's like listening to Matt Monro and right after you've dropped acid, because he's got this very sort of Frank Sinatra-ish kind of delivery.
Yeah.
The songs are these dense, weird, oddly produced, oddly arranged, you know, beautiful. You know, like you can play them for your mom or your grandmother, and I think she'd find them beautiful. But then all the references are something like from Sartre or from Bergman or something like that. You know, Ingmar Bergman or something like that. And so it's very weird. And I just love him. I adore him. So he was a big influence. Lee Hazlewood, Nancy Sinatra records were really big influence. And when you go back and hear some of what Lee wrote for Nancy, things like Some Velvet Warning.
Yeah.
It's diabolical that song was a hit because it's weird as fuck.
I gotta go back and listen to this.
You know, that's just bizarre. A lot of, particularly the songs where it was Nancy and, but even saying that, there are things like Lightning's Girl or Sugartown or things like that. They're odd. They're very Lynchian. You know, like, you know, like David Lynch has that really wonderful ability to hone in on the kind of weird, dark undercurrents and what looks like a candy-coated little piece of pop music.
Yeah.
And it's not simply because he's using it that it's so disturbing. He picks up on something and there's, we'll use that.
Something really is disturbing there.
So we really dig, like, Jimmy Webb, who still is alive. He's a singer, songwriter, producer, but he's really known for doing things like MacArthur's Park for Richard Harris. He wrote all these songs and produced all these songs for Richard Harris. He wrote...
Side note, did Richard Harris record that first?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's so funny. I always thought it was a Donna Summer song.
No. It's like, it is big. And those records are wacko.
Yeah,
they
I have that
absolutely...
one.
Absolutely bananas, those albums. And he can't sing at all, which really becomes fascinating when you listen to them, because, you know, we actually toyed around with doing covers of some of the songs and listen to the ones that Richard Harris sang and just go like, what the fuck note is that? Like, you kind of have to make an assumption. Well, I gather the melody would go, if he could sing at all, you'd go da-da-da-da right there. Do you know what I mean? Because he's not even... You know, it's the vocal hits a wall because he's such a terrible vocalist, but in a way it works so really, really well. So that's Serge Gainsbourg records, and not only his own records, which are just so outstanding, but the records he produced for Jane Birkin, for Isabella Gianni, for, you know, Brigitte Bardot, all those kind of things. Those were really big influences. And I think... I have to. It's not so much Johnny, but me, Bobby Gentry. I'm obsessed with Bobby Gentry.
I think it's the greatest hits of hers, but it has, of course.
Ode to Billy Joe.
Yeah, Ode to Billy Joe, and then the other one, Fancy, right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that she had originated that for a long
time.
Her
stuff is so. There's an album called The Local Gentry.
Yeah.
That is so gothic and so dark.
Yeah.
And I love just the way those records sound, and I got to do a shout out to Saint Dusty too, because Dusty Springfield is ginormous. That was another thing that Johnny and I bonded over. We're both obsessed with Dusty Springfield.
Yeah,
and she's probably when people ask me, like, as a singer, who are you influenced by, my female goddess is Dusty Springfield.
Yeah, because she's just check her out some more.
She's when she's at her height of her powers. To about the, you know, from like the early 60s to the early 70s, there's nobody comparable. She's just devastating. And also, I gotta name check Burt Bacharach and Hal David, because that's enormous influence too.
Right.
You know, we love Burt Bacharach and Hal David. And that's filtered through things like, you know, a lot of, you know, I think, because the two of us have taste, if I may be so presumptuous, we love the Banshees, we love Susie and the Banshees, we love Soft Cell, we love the Smiths, we love Roxy Music records in the 70s, we love David Bowie records in the 70s. We both really like dub records, you know, dub reggae records.
Yeah.
And so a lot of that gets filtered through, you know, a lot of the influences I just spoke of get filtered through that. The sort of art rock stuff. Johnny is obsessed with Sparks, and I love Sparks as well.
Oh, that's funny. Wait, Sparks. Cool Places, is that one of their songs?
Yes,
did with Jane Wheedland?
Exactly.
I had it on like a little K-Tel.
You have to listen to the
high school.
The early 70s records are just out fucking rageous. Bizarre, outrageous glam rock. And just they're quite unlike anything else.
Yeah.
That's come before or since. Like the record Come On In My House. Propaganda and Indiscreet. They're just astonishing records. And so that kind of stuff is very... And there's like I know in my personal, in my own, there is stuff now that I quite, you know, I like a great deal.
Yeah.
But I really dig Broadcast. I think they're a fantastic band. I really dig Ladytron. I'm an enormous fan of Goldfraps. I really like them.
Yeah.
I really like the band Stereo Total. I like Air. They've been a little problematic the last couple of releases, but to be really fair, I haven't heard the new one, so I don't. I don't. I shouldn't make any.
They have a brand new one now, don't they?
Yeah, they
Something
do.
Just
and
come
it's
out?
Been it's been very hit or miss the last the record or two. They'll do one that's a little dodgy, and then they'll do something that's really good, and they'll do something that's kind of dodgy.
Yeah. It seems like they'd be right up your alley, though.
Oh, I love
they
them.
Have that like
I mean,
that sound.
Certainly, the first like the first three records I adore. There was the fourth one that was a little. Iffy, I'm blanking on the name of that one, but there was a little iffy. But I always felt that that album's iffy because they had blown all their good ideas on Charlotte Gonsberg's album.
Oh, I didn't know they did an album.
Yeah, where they did kind of contemporaneously with their own album. They were producing and writing a Charlotte Gonsberg album, and the one that came out a couple of years ago, and I think they just kind of blew all their good ideas on the Charlotte Gonsberg
record.
Oh,
that's too bad.
Because all the songs on the Charlotte Gonsberg record they write are fantastic, and then their own album comes out, and it's kind of like, you didn't save any ideas for yourself, did you?
It seems like they should have just like, let's just leave this album alone and make a new one.
Yeah, you know, I mean, like, I think they kind of like, because it really does feel that way, because they're not a band in any way, shape, or form that I could write off.
Yeah.
You know, needless to say, there were lots of things too. Like, you know, we were talking about it earlier. Like, I really love this Massive Attack. I really love Trickery Records. Some of that stuff now is getting a little more problematic in what they've done of late. But a record like Mezzanine had an enormous impact on me creatively. A record like Maxim Quaye by Tricky had an enormous influence on me.
Extra points for being able to pronounce that too.
I met him. That's the only reason.
Oh,
like, you know, that's the only reason.
Maxim Quaye.
Yeah.
Maxim Quaye.
Yeah. And and the Portishead records, and that was one. You know, that Portishead record that came out last year, which kind of like, you know, they fell off the face of the planet for 10 years, and they come back, and it's a fucking fantastic album.
Yeah, it was really great. I was kind of like, I had low expectations for it.
Yeah.
But it was.
I mean, maybe it benefited a bit from that because you were kind of like, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, what are they going to be like after? But that was really, and it was impressive too because you didn't get the impression they had just simply been caught in amber for 10 years.
Yeah.
And they were going to come out and it's going to sound exactly like we were when we stopped.
Yeah. So they definitely grew.
Definitely grew.
Yeah.
So that was really, so there's definitely that kind of, you know, there's definitely that stuff out there. There were people like, Little Annie, who's a dear friend of ours and who's on the album, who just makes beautiful music. She's on the track on Villainous called Sleeping Beauty.
Okay.
And you know who I adore is Baby D, who is a singer-songwriter, a transsexual singer-songwriter.
Oh.
And D is just outrageous. Writes truly beautiful, you know, no disrespect to Anthony, because Anthony's stuff is fantastic too, but I think in a way D's stuff is even a little more challenging.
Yeah.
A little more it doesn't this sounds bitchy, but it doesn't coast on its classiness in a way that Anthony's stuff can do for me sometimes.
Yeah.
Do you know what
I mean?
I have
to check it out. Baby D?
Baby D.
I always
Baby
think
D.
of Supersonic.
Yeah, I mean, he's fantastic. She's huge. That's one of the things I love her when you see her perform. She's like 6'5", and she plays the piano and the harp. And and just writes some of the most beautiful songs. I mean, just really, just like, really, really gorgeous songs. So that's somebody I'm really impressed with.
That's quite a list.
That's quite a list. I could go on for hours.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff I like. A lot of stuff I listen to.
Let's listen to another song of yours, shall we?
Sure.
This one's from, I'm looking at my little playlist on my phone. That's why we're doing, Innsmouth Jewelry?
Innsmouth Jewelry.
Innsmouth Jewelry?
Yes, exactly. Innsmouth Jewelry, again, snagged from H.P. Lovecraft. I really like H.P. Lovecraft. This song, Influence again, so it kind of all dovetails, don't it? a big influence on me, much more on me than on Johnny, was the band Coil, which was John Bounce and Peter Christopherson. And this is our tribute to him, to John Bounce. Bounce died due to a mishap, an alcohol-related mishap. He was somebody who never could kind of get it.
Yeah.
He had a bad problem with alcohol for many years and could never quite pull it together. And eventually he was very, very drunk, and he fell, I think, either down a flight of stairs or off. And, like, they had a mezzanine, and he fell off it.
Oh, man.
And it killed, the fall killed him.
Oh, shit.
And it was, like, that happened right at a time in my life when I was dealing with a lot of issues, you know, with addiction stuff and
right.
kind of going into being in recovery and stuff like that. So it was very emotionally, that was very heavy for me at that time, because it's also one of those situations when someone dies and you suddenly realize, oh my God, this person's had this profound influence,
yeah,
you know, on what you do. Because I, you know, he died and it was really heartbreaking, and I just started listening to all these records by Coil and just like, holy fuck, I have nixed so, you know, I've stolen so many ideas from
yeah.
him as a writer, and just sonically, you know, when I'll say we're mixing something, I'm like, can we make it sound like whatever, whatever, and I'll go, you know, that's an idea that I'm snagging from Love's Secret Domain
right.
or Horse Rotovator or something, like one
yeah.
of the records. So we this song, what's funny was Johnny was trying to create something that sounds like the Carpenters. I'm trying to feeding in all this stuff about John Bounce via H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah.
And we got just an amazing vocal on this by a young lady named Andrea Vaughn, who was in a tremendous New York band called My Favorite.
Okay.
And just one of the most dynamic live bands I ever saw. They made one record, and it's a really good record, but it just doesn't quite capture the sheer, like, joie de vivre of them live. They
yeah.
were just fantastic. And the members of that band are in another band now. I'm totally, oh God, Michael will butcher me because I'm having another senior moment. I'm forgetting. Secret History, that's what they're called
okay.
now. That's the band. They're most of that band, except for Andrea. I don't think Andrea is doing vocals right now. But this song, I think, has such an amazing quality because we got Andrea to
okay,
sing on
cool.
that record. So, yeah, there's a lot of... So that's the intro to that.
All right, perfect.
And just like the thing Innsmouth Jewelry in the H.P. Lovecraft story, there are these, the entire monstrous civilization living on the seafloor. And one of the things that this character and the narrator of the story begins to realize that these creatures are infested this little coastal town in Massachusetts is he finds these bizarro bits of gorgeous but really kind of sinister and alien-looking jewelry. So that's the reference to the title.
All right. So here we go.
Okay.
It's jewelry.
Daring skin divers brave undersea perils that stagger the imagination.
Just
darkness is something to see. Will you still sing songs for me, Jeffrey? From the bottom of the sea.
So I just realized I don't have much time left to finish this interview. So we're going to go ahead and say goodbye and listen to one more song. Thanks for taking the time to do the show.
Thank you for having me, man. This has been lovely.
And where can we find you?
We're all over the place. We can be found at mistyroses.com, Misty Roses Facebook, / Misty Roses Music. We're on Facebook, on MySpace at MySpace / Misty Roses. You know, feel free to just send us an email, or you know, we have an email list. We're we are gigging out a bit in New York. You know, over the next, even though Johnny's in London, I'm sort of kind of have an autonomous way of performing the material. So that's happening with some regularity, and we've already started recording stuff for what the next record will be. So
cool.
There's new songs. I'll forward you one of the brand new songs.
All right.
You can hear that.
So I should wrap it up. I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay.
So our last song from you guys is
Nicholas Ultra, and again, it's movie references. The title is the name of a. It's the name of a. There's a fashion show in the Fellini film. Toby Dammit or Never Bet the Devil Your Head. It's a short film, part of a three-film wacky, psychedelic adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe called Spirits of the Dead from the 60s. And in this movie, there's a fashion show at what is like the Italian Academy Awards, and the clothes have these amazing titles like Flux Within Flux and, you know, things like that. That's the name of the costumes, the outfits. And one of them is Nick plus Ultra, which means kind of nothing plus Ultra.
Oh, got it.
I think knee plus Ultra is a terminology from like the 40s to mean something like that's the top of the top, like the creme de la creme. And so he had something called Nick plus Ultra, which means kind of nothing.
Oh,
you
I
know.
See.
But I just love that terminology. And this lyric, all these lyrics are just essentially kind of describing who you're taken with in terms of cinematic genres. So the person is as beautiful and cool as a science fiction film, as a European horror movie, as a Hercules movie, a sword and sandal movie, or as a, it's like each verse is a science fiction film, a European horror film, a sword and sandal film, a Hercules film, a film where guys are running around in loincloths.
Love it.
Steve Reeves and Ridge Park. It's better than porn. And then finally, the last stanza is all imagery from La Dolce Vita. So it's sort of Europe, the kind of art house European films. And it's all images of essentially... God, I'm having a senior moment again. Who is the big Zaftig Frau in La Dolce Vita? It'll come to me in a year or two. Bouncing around the fountain, you know, dancing and being in the Trevi Fountain and stuff like that. So that's kind of the whole. You know, that's kind of the thing of the whole song.
Got it. Okay. All right, here it is. Sorry to cut you short.
That's cool.
And we'll... Thanks again.
Thank you.
Too. Okay. With some Asandra Boat speeding it. I don't want to wait hours doing it.